When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dayton Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy.
Also, normally we have another co-host, Hugh Syme, as you all know, but Hugh is gone in Scotland for the Rush convention, being Mr. Famous Rush guy. So best wishes to Hugh in his travels.
For a minute, yeah.
Our guest today on Music Buzz Podcast is legendary musician Russell Hitchcock, who met Graham Russell in 1975. And formed Air Supply. That group had many, many huge radio hits in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The list is long. All Out of Love, Lost in Love, Making Love Out of Nothing at All, and many more. Hitchcock has also released solo albums, solo singles over the years, hits like Swear to Your Heart, etc., and continues with Air Supply to this day. So welcome to the Music Buzz, Russell Hitchcock.
Thank you, sirs. Hi, Dane.
Hey, man. It's a pleasure to have you here, Russell. I'd like to start out by talking about the newest Air Supply video and song, Be Tough. Man, your voice, it's unmistakable, stronger than ever. The song is quintessential Air Supply. It's very impressive, and it's got an important message to the world in 2023 that you got to be tough to survive, I think. The first minute or so of the video, the blindfolded people kind of spilling their innermost fears and emotions, it really caught me by surprise. Very captivating. Can you tell us about the song and video, which I believe is the first thing you guys have done since the Mumbo Jumbo record, maybe? Yeah.
Since before the dinosaurs.
Yeah, 2010 or so.
You know, Graham writes all the songs these days. He's very private about his influences and inspirations. However, the guy that came up with the concept for the video, it just worked tremendously. I mean, it's nice to get to know somebody first without seeing them, because then you get to know the real person and you're not affected by how pretty they are or handsome or ugly they are. And, you know, there was a few scenes that are same-sex conversations. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff now is really pertinent these days. And obviously, we've gotten a bit of flack for it, but bottom line is it's a beautiful song. And as you said, Dane, it has a great message. We hope to, well, people are enjoying it. We play it live. It goes down great there. So, you know, let's see. But we need to, and we're not crusaders, certainly, but we need to, everybody needs to be a lot more kind to other people, look at their perspectives. And who knows if that's going to happen. In that regard, I'm kind of very pessimistic because I've been on this planet since 1949 and, you know, went through the 60s, which was an amazing time. It was peace and love to the nth. 70s was great. 80s started to turn a bit. 90s, I didn't care for too much at all. And here we are. The state of affairs that we're living is not great these days.
I think it's a bold statement. And again, the sonically, it sounds great. Your voice sounds great. Is there more stuff you guys have in the pipeline for release?
We've recorded four songs in the last month or so. We're going to do some vocals in Vancouver next week. And in September, I believe, we're going to cut a couple more tracks. So, you know, our intention was initially to put a single out by whatever means we could once every 3 months. But Graham's a very prolific songwriter, and he always runs stuff by me. Do you think this is good? What do you think of this? And I said, we should, look at doing something a bit more serious and put an album out. So we've been working between shows on the road, and you know what this is like. You grab the time when you can to do it, but we hopefully will have a complete album, if that's what you still call them, by November.
So we're talking about current Air Supply. Take us back to 1975 or before, when the two of you first started working together. What was it that brought you two guys together and still be around all these years later? It's pretty phenomenal. Yeah.
We met in a production of Jesus Christ Superstar in Australia, in Sydney, in 1975, May the 12th. I don't know, we just kind of gravitated to each other in the show. This was my first experience in music, being in Superstar. Hadn't sung professionally ever, and I was in my mid-20s. And my girlfriend at the time kind of nagged me into going to the auditions. Met Graham, and there were some people from the previous production in 1972 that was over the theatre people, and they knew everything, they thought, and had a very snooty attitude towards newcomers. There were the people that were musicians that got into the show and trained singers, and then there was Graham and I, among a few other people, that had no training whatsoever. Graham had supported himself as a singer-songwriter for some years, but I had no clue. So everybody formed their little clique, no matter which one it was. And we kind of started talking on the first day of rehearsals, I remember, and we found out that we had a lot in common. Our birthdays are 4 days apart in the same month. We both saw the Beatles in 64 in England and Australia, respectively.
Okay.
We liked the same kind of music, melodic, harmonic stuff, and rock and roll as well. I like the same kind of movies, same kind of food, just a lot of things that kind of, meshed together that we could talk about. We were seated in the men's chorus room together, coincidentally, and we started this show in the same pod, they were called, together. So we spent a lot of time chatting and hanging out together. But it wasn't maybe 2 or 3 weeks after we first met that I heard Graham playing an original song. And he plays, I don't know if you know this, he plays a right-handed guitar and just flips it over. That's the way he taught himself to play. And he didn't know he wasn't doing it the right way, but it sounds different and it sounds really cool. And anyway, he played me this song, and we got together after that and started to work on that song together. And we thought we harmonized pretty well. And, he said he was always determined, and I'm not the guy. I'm not like, he's super driven. I like to be driven. And he said, we should do something when the show is over and not wait for the show to finish and then try and find something to do. So during the course of the show over the next 18 months, we practiced songs that he'd written. We did club dates, just the two of us, acoustic guitar playing covers and a couple of original things. So by the time the show had ended in 1976, we'd managed to secure a record deal in Australia. We had a song released called Love and Other Bruises, which was a monster hit there. The album with that song went crazy. And the day we finished Superstar on a Saturday, and on Monday we were on the road as Air Supply for the first time. So we opened for one of the guys that was played Judas in the show, who was very gracious in letting us open for him. And then we were asked to open for Rod Stewart in Australia in January. And this is in the space of 3 or 4 months. And
well, this was in 76.
Well, we're in 77 now when we did the show.
January 77.
We did three shows with Rod, I think. And after the first one, he came backstage, and we were like, whoa, this is Rod Stewart. And introduced himself, and he said that he was touring later that year in the US and would be interested in opening for him all over North America and Canada. So that was a no-brainer. And so came to the US for the first time in July, recorded a compilation of our first two Australian albums, and then went on the road with him in September through December and played places that, you know, one dreams of: Madison Square Garden and Three River Stadium, Spectrum, Forum, Candlestick Park, you know, all the big joints. So it was a wonderful learning experience for us.
Yeah, I would reckon that's awesome. That's really when he was, not certainly he's kind of never not been at his peak in some ways, but that was like...
He was definitely, I mean, the biggest star in the world then. It was...
Yeah, I was going to say that might have been his biggest, biggest period. Time frames for sure. Yeah.
I thought that I read that when, you know, despite all the success that you'd had when you went back, you didn't have any money. Like, what did you have to scrounge for pennies in the back of couches to buy some bread? Tell us what happened.
Well, that's absolutely true. We were gone for 3 months from Australia, and I guess during that period, there was no feedback coming from the US about what we were doing and who we were doing it with. I mean, I think it got a mention in the paper before we left. And we went back, and I tell this story during the show, got back to Sydney, and I was taking my bags through customs on a trolley, and I heard all these women screaming outside these big doors that you couldn't see through, they were wooden doors. And I thought, we made it, you know, we're successful. So, of course, I opened the door and they were all waiting for a different band.
Damn.
So I crawled off into the sunset, and we couldn't get arrested. I mean, we were offered shows for $200 a night, and there were seven of us at that time in the band.
Oh,
jeez. People just didn't want to know. And I hate the term soft rock, but that's what we got labelled with. And in my opinion, we were never that live, and we aren't. But in Melbourne at the time, where we actually went back to, all the venues were pubs, very hard rock, AC/DC, Midnight Oil, that kind of thing. And, of course, we'd get on stage with our white suits and afros, and, you know, sometimes we got stuff thrown at us and sometimes we didn't. And but we just stuck to our guns until it got so ridiculous that Graham went to Adelaide, which is in South Australia, and I went to stay with my sister in Melbourne because I couldn't afford to live anywhere. And he wrote some songs. Included in those was The Loves, Lost in Love, All Out of Love, and what was the one that you love? So he said, why don't you come to Adelaide? I think I've got some songs that could be cool. And he played Lost in Love for me, just acoustic, and him singing. And I said, if we can get this out, it's going to be a monster. I mean, I just had that feeling about it. So we once again secured a record deal in Sydney. That song was a huge hit for us there. And it took 2 years to get that song to the US and the attention of Clive Davis at Arista Records. And he phoned us the day he got it, and he said to both of us, you've got to get over here, we have to do an album. And of course, you know, after that we had, I don't know, six or seven top five songs, and it launched our career worldwide.
It tied you with the Beatles, I think I read, for at least for a while there, right?
Yeah, at least for a week.
Well, hey, though, say that? How many people?
I'll take it, yeah.
So 1964, you said, is that when you saw the Beatles, you said?
Yeah.
So where was that show at?
It was at the Festival Hall in Melbourne.
Okay.
It was around my birthday, which is the 15th. My cousin got us tickets to go see it. And, you know, as you can imagine, in those days, there was no PA. Nothing was mic'd, none of the instruments. And they had two little speaker columns, maybe a foot wide, with six-inch speakers in each one on each side of the stage for the vocals, and you could hear, I think they played six songs, which was what they did in those days, because there were like 10 or 15 acts on the bill, and they closed the show, and you could hear like, you know, But I was there and I saw him.
Yeah.
That's all that matters now, right?
That was it. But the I was just speaking to someone and they people don't these days, I don't know how old you guys are, certainly not as old as me, but they had a civic reception for the Beatles in Melbourne. And at the time, the population of Melbourne was about 1.5 million. And 300,000 people showed up outside the town hall.
Wow.
Just to see them come out and wave from the balcony, you know.
Wow.
And obviously their influence, I mean, once I saw them, I still didn't have any ambition to be in music. I don't know why. But that's all I could listen to. I mean, I pasted my room with Beatles photos. I bought everything, Beatles magazine, and I bought a plastic mop top wig and Cuban boots, Cuban heel boots, and everything I could that was Beatles affiliated. And they did change my life, absolutely.
All of our lives.
Yes.
In some way.
Yeah,
no question.
What do you think of Ringo as a drummer, Dane?
I think he's fantastic. Love him. I mean, he swings great. His parts, he's a smart, the parts that he came up with. And I know that they took, you know, that McCartney would give him ideas. John would say, why don't you try this? And, you know, he would do that. But whatever he came up with on those records are really interesting drum parts.
Yeah. I was fascinated with the snare sounds he got on, or they got on each album. I mean, some of the stuff, I don't know how they did it. Well, I saw the towel on the snare in Get Back.
Oh, yeah, the tea towels. Yeah,
yes.
Fabulous. Yeah. And the way that the drum sounds and the sounds of the band evolved with George Martin's production and Jeff Emmerich. And, God, I'm a super fan. So, yeah, I mean,
me too. Great.
You know, it's all changed a lot with Sgt. Pepper. That's when they took the head off the bass drum.
Is that right?
The first time, I think.
Yeah.
And that's where you get more of a boo, you know, you get more impact. And I don't know when the tea towels came into play, but it might have been about that time too. But, oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, that was fascinating seeing that. Of course, there was a lot fascinating about that documentary, but yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then here you are, but you saw those guys in 64, and here it is in 1980 or so, and you're tying them for the number of consecutive hits. But not bad, man. Pretty good. Pretty good deal.
Those kinds of things. And I think I have a newspaper cutting with that information. It was on the bottom of, remember, USA Today. Air Supply ties the Beatles and Michael Jackson with a number of songs in the top 10 or whatever.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, those, as great as it is, and, you know, I mean, I'm very proud of that fact that we did it for like a week or so, whatever it was. You know, it's like that's gone now. And it's part of history.
We're still talking about it.
It's part of history. So a couple years after that, I'm just going to say three words and you tell me what you remember about this day. Minnesota State Fair, 1982.
Yeah, that was a good one for me. We were just about at the end of the show. And in those days, I used to have a few glasses of red wine to steal my nerves. And there was the main stage, and the sound system was on each side of the stage, but there was a gap in between the speaker supports. And I went over in front of one of the speaker stacks, and I looked down and saw the gap there, but when I came back, I didn't see the gap. And I fell 15 feet onto this concrete raceway and broke my arm and bruised a couple of ribs, and that was the end of that show. And I remember Graham, which is still, it's funny now, it wasn't, and he was looking down at me, still playing guitar.
Oh,
he was still playing guitar.
He was trying to keep the song going, and he's going, uh-oh.
Show must go on. Anyway,
what's your memory of that? Like, do you remember?
Oh, really? Absolutely.
Okay.
I remember falling, and I put my arms out to break my fall, which, you know, was what broke my left arm. And I rolled on my back instinctively, and I couldn't feel anything. And I thought I'd broken my back.
Sure.
And that freaked me out. But the ambulance and medical staff was there within, I don't know, 90 seconds. And, you know, I started to be able to breathe, not very well. And they took me to hospital, put my arm in a cast, obviously, and they couldn't do anything for my ribs because they had to heal themselves. And that was the worst pain ever because we quite foolishly did play a show the next night in Kansas City, the Starlight Theatre.
Oh, man. You played the next night?
You played a show the next night?
Well, come on now. You're a trooper, dude. Wow.
I was naive then. And I sat on a stool, and every time I took a huge breath, somebody was slicing me in half with a cheese knife, you know.
Man.
And that was a painful couple of weeks till I was healed enough to move around again. But I'll never forget that. And thanks for bringing it up. I appreciate that.
And, sorry, man.
No. So, and, you know, I guess that's one of the, what is it, the things you have to go through. You're not cool unless you fall off the stage once, you know.
Man.
Well, God, you know, thankfully it wasn't any worse than it was. I mean, my gosh. Yeah. Could have been a lot worse.
There's a YouTube video of us playing on the Glen Campbell show, and he played guitar with us, and we sang Even the Nights Are Better, and I still have my cast on.
Oh, really? Okay.
Who were interested?
Oh, that's cool. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. Check that out. So you made reference earlier about soft rock, and it's interesting when you said that. It made me think of something because during COVID, I worked with a streaming company doing marketing PR stuff, and you guys were one of the ones that we worked on because you did the Valentine's Day streaming
shows. Yeah.
And I remember, you know, there was, you know, just working on that or whatever, and I watched the show. And I remember it really striking me watching the show because I remember thinking, this band is a lot more badass than I kind of expected. And I, not that I expected it to be bad, I just didn't expect it to really rock, and it did. And so it was interesting because even the songs that it's not like they were changed so much that they didn't sound like the songs, but they were just different in a really cool way. And so when you said that earlier, I was like, he's right, because I saw that and experienced that in a good way. You know, sometimes people change up their music and it's like, just play it the way I want to hear it. But that wasn't it. But not just the two of you either, but talk a little bit about the guys in your band. That band, I distinctly remember this is a really good, really good band.
Well, the current band, and we've been through, I don't know how many incarnations of people playing with us. But just before I tell you about that, all the early recordings, as you know, were very orchestrated, lush strings everywhere.
Right.
And, you know, they were mixed the right way for that background, you know. But we've always, we thought we were rock and roll, you know, not Led Zeppelin, obviously, but we're the other end of the scale. But we've always looked, when there was a change in the band, we looked for guys that were contemporary. I mean, all the guys are younger than us. Well, because we're older than everybody else anyway. But,
We didn't. Yeah.
We found, you know, our lead guitarist, Aaron McLean, is a monster. And he basically found or knew our pianist and our bassist, both, you know, younger guys. The drummer we just found, and he's a powerhouse. And they bring whatever their influences are to the show and to the songs. And we're great sticklers, Graham and I, for, as you said, I don't want to go to a show and guess the song. I want to hear the song the way I remember it. But the way that these guys have added their, you know, special flavors to the songs have made, elevated them, I think. And one of the reasons why we continue to tour at such a high level and do many shows is because it's an entertaining rock and roll show. I remember the first shows we did, I played conga drums strictly because I really wanted something to hide behind because I was too scared to be out front, you know. And if I didn't play those, I would walk out and grab the microphone stand in two places and in a death grip and do the show because I was terrified. We've progressed leaps and bounds, you know, eons, whatever you want to call it. So the sound of the band has gotten really a lot tougher, and it's hard to talk to people that haven't seen you and tell them it's a rock and roll band when all they're used to is the early recordings of Lost in Love and Two Less Lonely People. That are,
Right. Yeah.
And it took us a long time to get over that. But, you know, in the early parts of playing with this band, we would get 10 or 15 people because we our audience is now from the, you know, 6 to 60. So we found that people that were older, you know, there'd be 10 of them in the audience going like this. And they would complain to me on stage. And I would say, that guy up there, he's mixing. I'm not mixing. I'm just singing, you know. And that's become less and less so that, you know, we find now that even the generation, you know, that I'm a part of, they dig it because they know what to expect, the ones that have seen us before. And they've encouraged their friends to come and see it because, you know, it's loud. It's in your face. You know, you want to hear the bass drum hit you in the chest.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be a physical thing as well for us, for the audience, you know.
Yeah. No, I was struck by that for sure. And you hit the nail on the head explaining the band. So kudos to that because it's a cool show. There's no question about it. It's I distinctly remember watching it all and thinking this is really cool. So congrats to you and your band on that. So we were talking to Jody Stevens actually earlier today from Big Star and talked a little bit about songwriting partners and working together as a duo, et cetera. What is it about the two of you guys, you know, working together all these years, having met, you know, way back in the mid 70s in Melbourne? What is that? What's the secret sauce, I guess?
Well, the secret sauce is that there isn't one. I mean, we both have very defined roles in the band. I mean, I couldn't write a song if you paid me. I've tried to write lyrics and they all suck. Okay. And we're kind of like not in the same vein as Elton John and Bernie Taupin. Graham writes the songs and then he sends them to me.
Right.
And says, what do you think of this? And nine times out of 10, I'll go, this is great. Or I predicted Lost in Love and The One That You Love to be hits as soon as I heard them, the instant I heard them. So he does that and then he'll play guitar or piano and send me the song and let me know what you think. He'll sometimes say, I think you should sing this or this is in your key or I'd love you to sing this. But it all happens in the studio because we also believe it's what's best for the song. And there's been a couple of instances where I was supposed to sing All Out of Love. And I just couldn't, I don't know, for whatever reason, the chorus wasn't, you know, clicking with me. And I said to Graham, why don't you go and give it a shot? And he said, oh, that's too high for me. And I said, just go and sing it, see what happens. So that's the version that you hear now. But really, I mean, I think the secret to our success is, first of all, there's no secret. There's that process of bringing songs into our repertoire. We're also very different people. He lives on 1,000 acres in Utah outside of Park City. He's very, you know, green. He's got a 3,000-4,000 square foot greenhouse. He has, you know, deer in his backyard. And, he's the garden guy and the outdoorsman. Doesn't hunt, however. He's vegan. And I want to be close to a restaurant that's within 2 hours. Instead of driving 20 miles to Salt Lake City. We don't see each other when we're not working together. We talk, you know, if we've got a long break, which is a long for us, is a couple of weeks, we usually touch base once a week to see what's going on. Or if there's any business needs to be attended with our manager, we do calls like this. We respect each other tremendously because he's, in my opinion, he's one of the most underrated writers of pop songs ever. Never been nominated for a Grammy. Neither of us had brothers either, so he's the brother I never had, and I love him as a brother. We've been through both musically, professionally, and personally stuff that, you know, would probably separate a lot of people, but we're always there for each other when the crunch comes. And we're also, we didn't start the band when we were kids. You know, I was in my mid-20s and he's a year younger than me. So I think we got into it pretty level-headed And, you know, I've never gone, I'm the lead singer and I'm the best guy. And he's, well, I write the song, so I'm better than you. Never. We've connected on every level professionally and personally that you could. And the other thing is too, you know, ain't broke, don't fix it. We don't take it for granted, but we take it for granted because we're always there and always with each other, you know. And if you can't get along with the guy you've been working with for 50 years nearly, then what's the point? And I know acts, and you probably do as well, you guys, that they can't stand each other, but they get on stage and pretend that they're best buddies, you know. And I couldn't work with Graham if I didn't like what I was doing. If I didn't like him, I wouldn't do it. You know, it's just not part of my makeup.
Yeah, good for you guys, man.
Yeah, I mean, these songs are timeless songs. There's no question. I mean, these are, you know, you guys know it. I mean, all these years later, I remember my first memory, I think, of Air Supply. My mom, she was, you know, a member of those, the Columbia House, you know, record things,
right,
which were awesome because you'd get, you know, you'd go out to the mail and get like, you know, 10 vinyls or whatever in the mail.
And never pay for it.
Or 10 cents or whatever it was.
Yeah, exactly. 10 cents. But I remember getting, that was one of those, and it played a lot at our house. And those songs are timeless. They still sound as good today as they did then. I mean, that's, I guess, dialing back to those times and making those hits that were just became monsters and still live on to this day. You know, take us back to that time. Was that, did you know it at the time? Did you feel like, gosh, these are bona fide classics?
Well, I mean, as the years go by, you come to realize that that's what's happening. But the early days, as soon as we had Lost in Love was a hit, we were touring incessantly, mostly on a bus. You know, we were doing 100,000 miles a year, and we didn't get off the bus for 3 months at a time, really. And it got to the point where, and this is, we didn't really get a chance to stop and smell the roses, you know. We'd be on the bus at 3 o'clock in the morning and sitting up listening to, we used to listen to AC/DC all the time, or we still do if we can, and have a beer and somebody would say, oh, Here I Am's number 5. We go, oh, that's cool. You know, can you get me another beer?
Yeah, great.
And I mean, you know, everybody goes through this and you don't take it for granted, but when we made our first recording in Australia, the producer gave me a copy of Love and Other Bruises, a 45. And for you folks that don't know, that's a plastic black thing with a hole in the middle. And he gave it to me and I said to Graham, this thing here is forever. I mean, this is people, my kids and their kids and their kids and their kids going to play this forever if they choose to. This is immortal. And then I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to have a gold record, a gold album? And we got that in Australia pretty quickly. And gold in those days was 20,000 copies. But that was a big deal. And I still have mine hanging on the wall downstairs. And then we wanted to go to America. We separated from our record company in Australia because they said, we want you to stay in Australia. We can make you the biggest band in Australia. And we said, we don't want to be the biggest band in Australia. We want to be the biggest band in the world. Mm-hmm. And it was a very acrimonious separation. Then we got to America and I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a platinum album? And we got that and you get that and take photos with it and then you take it home. And then I want a multi-platinum album. We got that. Mm-hmm. And then our greatest hits album sold 5 million in the US alone. Yeah. That was a great achievement. But, you know, all those things, I don't know whether you experience it too. Once you get there, it's not what you thought it was going to be. And, you know, you just got to move on because you can't live on your last recordings or your last performance because you've got the rest of your life that you have to keep your nose to the grindstone and get on with it, you know?
Sure.
So which you guys are still doing. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. My next question is tattoos. I mean, When did you start becoming an aficionado of tattoos and getting tattoos? Those are cool tattoos.
They are, man.
Yeah. I got my first one when my daughter was born in 1988. You can't even see it anymore. I was so scared to get it. I said, give me the smallest rose that you can put on there. And with every tattoo artist, they always say, go big because you'll regret not doing it. You know. So anyway, I didn't. Mm-hmm. And then I quite liked it, and I was married at the time. And I said to my wife, I think I'm going to get another tattoo. And she said, why don't you get Peter Pan? Because it's obvious you're never going to grow up. And I said, good idea. So
I got that. Oh, nice. That's
awesome.
Great. Yeah.
And there you go. You showed
then,
her.
Yeah.
Then I started.
That was an ex-wife, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, bye now. Toodles.
Well, yeah. And then I didn't do any for quite a while. I got quite a few in the 90s, some stuff on my chest. But just recently, my lovely, beautiful wife now, Carrie, is smiling at me. She has a tattoo guy, and she went and got one, and I thought, oh, may as well give it a shot. And I've kind of been obsessed ever since. There's not much space left, but I'm going to find a spot. I'm actually going to get Air Supply tattooed around here because I don't have a – if I get in a car accident, people will know who I was. You know?
Right.
Oh, that's that guy.
But like, is it Peter Pan? Is it – who is this guy? Oh, he's the guy from Air Supply. Okay, yeah.
I mean, looking at you, though, I mean, I would think you'd be you are in Motorhead and not Air Supply or something, you know. It's great, man.
Well, yeah, well, you know.
That's great.
Graham was has been very encouraging, you know, because I said part of the show now I'm going to wear a sleeveless shirt to freak everybody out, which it kind of does. And he said, yeah, go ahead, man. That's who you are now. I mean, I wear earrings and I wear a lot of jewelry. And that's who I am, and I'm not bound by other people's opinions anymore, especially people that I was involved with. You know, don't do
good
that
for you.
That's too fairy. That's too blah blah. But Carrie's been my savior.
No, I think it's awesome.
Good for her. Yeah, I think it's great.
I have her signature on my arm too.
Oh yeah, cool.
Nice.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I've seen the Air Supply logo and obviously see it there in your shirt. I never thought of it as a tattoo, but it actually would make a really great tattoo. Mm-hmm. You know, just the logo.
The guy that does our tattoos, he designed this, our tattoo guy.
Oh, cool.
How cool.
That's like an album cover right there. That's awesome.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a good thought.
Yeah. Very cool.
Very cool.
So I read somewhere that you had some interesting stories about some folks in the business. Don't you want to get into that with us today? Axl Rose, Robert Plant, you got any stories about those fellas?
Yeah. I hope Axel's going to see this. we played a show in India in, I think, 1995. And it was, we were given an award for being, you know, the fabbest band in the universe or something. And so we went, and it was in a football stadium, a lot of people, and backstage was all just pipe and drape tent things, no specific dressing rooms, just had a card with the person's name on it.
Sure.
And Brian May was there, Roger Taylor, Brian Adams, the Macarena people, bunch of other things, and Robert Plant was there. He was going to perform with Brian May and Roger Taylor. And I walked where I was told, you know, just go down there and your name's on a tent there. And I walked past Robert Plant. And I'm a fan. I was a fan before I'm anything, and I'm a fan now before anything. And I saw him and I, you know, went, whoa, holy crap, it's Robert Plant. And I tried to, you know, go past him because all these reporters had microphones in his face. And he actually stopped them and he said, excuse me, to them. And he said, hi, I'm Robert Plant. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice.
And that's the classiest thing that anybody with that, you know, echelon of rock and roll.
Yeah, man, that's cool, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was awesome. And then my Axl Rose story. The people that used to work for us doing security ended up working for Guns N' Roses. And the head of our security guys was manager for them, Doug Goldstein. And I was in LA and he called me up and he said, I've got some good news and bad news for you. And I said, okay, what's the good news? And he said, Axel wants to have dinner with you. And I said, okay, what's the bad news? And he said, he wants to have dinner with you tonight. And I said, okay. So we went to the Rainbow. You've heard of that, right? You've been there? You must have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been there.
And I was sitting alone and they both came in and Axel was so effusive. Oh, you've got the best voice I've ever heard. And, you know, you're amazing and you're this and you're that. And I don't take flattery well anyway, or compliments. And I said, thanks, you know. And he said, on All Out of Love, you were supposed to have held the longest note ever on a recorded music. And I said, I don't know about that, but, and I didn't care, you know, that's what kind of stat is that, you know?
It's just what you did.
Yeah, it's what I did. And anyway, he said, would you mind if I recorded a song and kept a note longer than that? And I went, knock yourself out, bud. I mean,
that's weird. Whatever.
Wow. Yeah, so anyway, a little while later, Doug called me and he said, oh, Guns N' Roses are playing at the Freddie Mercury Memorial Concert in at Wembley in 1992. Do you want to go? And I said, well, I'd love to, and I can't afford to. You know, I'm not in that shape right now. And he said, oh, I'll take care of you. He said, you were the greatest guy I ever worked for, and I'd like to repay you in some small
way. Wow, that's nice.
And he said, don't worry about anything, airfares, first class hotel, blah, blah, blah. And I was really overwhelmed. So I flew over there with the Slash and Duff, and I don't know whether Stephen was in the band. No, it was Matt Sorum. And we, you know, they were great guys, had a great time with them on the plane. Went to the, checked in the hotel, and there was a sing-along that night at the piano in the lobby with Axel and whoever was there. And it was, I wish I'd had a cell phone then. That would have been great to record. Mm-hmm. Anyway, went to the show next day, and I walked into the garage to get up to where the stage was and the parking area, and I saw Axel standing up against a pillar in the parking garage. And I went up and I said, hey, Axel. And he just looked at me, didn't like respond. And I said, you remember me? And he said, no, I don't think so. And I said, yeah, Russell, I sing with Air Supply. We had dinner at the Rainbow with Doug. And he goes, no.
Whoa, what an asshole.
You allowed to swear on this?
Sure, yes, I just did. Go ahead.
Mine's worse. I said, fuck you, Axel. Have a nice show. And walked away. And I thought that was really cold, to say the least. And he was the only guy of everybody, David Bowie, Annie Lennox, you name it, George Michael, that had his own dressing room with two guys on each side of the door, you know.
Sure.
And we were watching the show as it progressed, and they'd just come off. And there was, you know, I don't know who was, I remember Joe Elliott was there because I was talking to him for a little bit. Mm. And the commentator came on, and with the stage in the background, he says, well, you know, welcome to the Freddie Mercury Memorial Concert. And apart from a lackluster set from Guns N' Roses.
Vindication.
Next thing, the doors burst open and Axel's going, where is that? I want him. I want him fired. I'm going to do this and that. And everybody's looking at him like, sit down. Back into your room.
Get over yourself, pal.
Yeah, really.
Come on now.
Wow.
I have nothing fond or nice to say about him.
Well, good that's for interesting. You.
I hate hearing it, but it doesn't surprise me for similar things.
I've had a couple of those in my career. When Lost in Love was first out and it was really successful, we played Red Rocks in Colorado, Denver. And Juice Newton opened for us. And she had Queen of Hearts, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I mean, I think I'm a relatively nice guy. So in anybody that's working with us, I always go up and say, hi, I'm Russell. Nice to meet you. Great to be working with you. And I went up to her and I put my hand out and I said, I'm Russell, sing with Air Supply. It's great to meet you. And she just looked at my hand and did nothing, you know.
And she was opening for you?
Yeah, and it makes you know, it's embarrassing, you think.
Sure.
Is anybody looking at me? Am I like a piece of shit? Or what?
And it's, no, it's kind of like Juice Who now. Like,
yeah. So, you know, you get those and then you get the people that are awesome. And we've done a lot of shows with America and Christopher Cross, and they're awesome people.
Yeah.
You know, Starship, Mickey Thomas is a great guy. You know, some people you didn't think would be so nice or awesome, and the people that you think are going to be shoot you down every time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, disappointment, isn't that the common theme for all of us in some ways, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're not used to it, don't be in a band.
No kidding. Well, don't be in the music business, right?
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, those songs that you sing, that when you go out and play and you guys still do 100 plus shows a year, I was reading, is it hard for you to sing night after night? And is it harder to do those? I mean, you know, you recorded those songs 40 years ago, so.
Yeah. Well, we've changed the key of a few of them down a step or half a step or something. But I look at early videos now, live videos, and I just stood there and went, you know, now it's like I'm making faces like I'm having an appendicitis attack, you know. So it's hard, but I'm lucky, you know. I just for the past, I stopped drinking about 17 months ago, and that's made a big difference. And, you know, I'm not an exercise person or any of that. I just try to eat properly now and get as much rest as I can because, and when during the day I don't speak, unless I have to, and I like this, and I get a lot of comments backstage. People say, "Your voice is so low and quiet." And I said, "I don't get paid to speak."
Good point. You're saving it, man. Come on now.
Yeah.
But people don't think about that kind of stuff at all. You know what I mean? They just don't.
Yeah.
No.
There's a guy in Australia that you've never heard of called John Farnham. And people say, who's got the best voice you ever heard? And he has it. And sadly, about a year ago, he got cancer in his mouth and they had to remove part of his jaw. So he's, you know, recuperating, hasn't been seen in public, which is obviously a good thing. But if you ever, well, you should write his name down and listen to him sing live a song called When the War is Over. And it's Farnham, F-A-R-H-N-A-M.
Farnham.
Yeah, F-A-R-H-A-M, sorry. And that guy does it, used to do it day after, night after night too, and I couldn't figure out how he did it because he's phenomenal. But, you know, we're lucky. I'm lucky, and we've been blessed too. We haven't really been sick over the years, you know. I mean, I've had surgery a couple of times, and fortunately the time period was good for that, you know. In fact, a couple of years ago I broke my ribs and fell out of a car, broke six ribs, and we had 6 weeks off then, so it was okay then. But we've been lucky, you know, touch wood or something, whatever you do.
Is there any other current things you want us to hit on in your world that we should have?
Not really. I mean, we're excited about finishing this these recordings. We're doing some work in Vancouver next week on vocals, and we hope to have that finished, by November. But, you know, we're getting involved in writing an autobiography.
Very nice. With
a guy, Graham and I, we're both writing separately and going to put them all together, which, you know, it's funny when you start to do something like that, you think of something and you think of 20 other things that happened. And, you know, hopefully people will find it interesting. And I was saying, I spoke to the guy that's going to write it with us today, and I said how much of the, you know, the underbelly kind of thing do you want from us, you know, because we're all always being perceived as clean, squeaky, and, you know, wouldn't say shit if you had a mouthful of it. And he said, say whatever you want, and whatever you want to address. And he said something interesting at the end of our conversation. He said, what do you want to do with the book? You know, what's your goal? And he said, to set the record straight. And I said, that's pretty much what it is, you know, just to show that we are, as we all are, regular people, and we have talent, but we got lucky, and you know, we'll see what happens. May I also say that my wife and I watched American Idol last night, and we were in Superstar for nearly 2 years with some amazing voices. I mean, amazing voices. And Graham and I often say, you know, wonder what happened to so-and-so, he had a great voice. And there are so many people that we all know that had amazing talent, it's, you know, something musically, and they never got a shot for some reason or another. And we are luckier than lucky, Graham and I, to be able to have been in the right place at the right time, and also take advantage of those opportunities and not let them go by us, you know.
Yep. I'm glad you did. Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Russell, and continued success and luck to you, and, you know, just keep on keeping on. So a lot of respect for what you guys do.
I must thank you for a wonderful interview. You guys are great. Thank you.
Thanks, Russell. Appreciate it, man.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.